Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Tonight I would like to talk about the notion of free will and how it relates to the Buddhist concept of anatta or non-self. I just arrived back in the U.S. about a week ago now. So there's certain terms associated with free will which tend to resonate with Americans. Things like independence, self-determination, self-sufficiency, autonomy, spontaneity. Right? There can be a lot of passion associated with these. There can also be a lot of attachment associated with that. So I'd like to talk about the role of what we assume to be free will and how it relates to other aspects of Buddhist practice. But also I'd like to put that in a bit of context. Anytime you take one aspect of the Buddhist teachings out of the wider context, there is the danger of it somehow going out of balance. So just to bring in the whole picture and how things fit, how the different pieces fit together, is always important to see. So I'm going to be talking about anatta. Anatta, or non-self, is the most distinctive teaching of the Buddha. All of the other teachings of the Buddha, you can find them in other spiritual traditions to some degree. But particularly anatta, the Buddha takes this idea of no intrinsic or enduring sense of self or identity, he takes that to a level that no other teaching, certainly that currently exists, has taken it. So in order to understand what anatta is, you have to also put it in context of what the term atta means. So generally in the time of the Buddha, there was the idea that, yes, we can see the body's non-self. You know, the body's not our true self. You know, when there was a quest to find, well, who are we really? What is the true self? You know, what's the essence of a human being? Well, it's not the body. The body comes and goes. You know, when a person passes away, then what happens? You know, the body's changing constantly. You know, we can see many other aspects of our life, personality go changing in flux. But behind that, there must be some unchanging, immutable, fixed entity, whether it's around us or whether it's inside of us, that somehow is our true self, that we can rely on, that we can reliably attach to in a spiritual way, attach to the sense of self with the idea that this will lead to salvation or unification with the ultimate. So these were the most common philosophies. In some way or other, almost all the different philosophies and religious and spiritual traditions at that time were postulating a sense of self in some way. And the Buddha just took it further and he said, look, no matter where you investigate, you cannot find anything that is enduring, even from one moment to the next. So I'd like to talk a bit about anatta, but also just a reminder that even though this evening I will be mainly focusing on what are generally considered the wisdom teachings, none of that is really possible to experience with any depth unless you take the whole picture, right? So If you try to take the wisdom teachings without the teachings in Silo or morality, or without the teachings of metta, karuna, loving kindness and compassion, if you try to take the wisdom teachings without just a general spirit of generosity and joy, and developing all these well-rounded aspects of the path, then they don't really sink in. But tonight I'm going to be mainly focusing on some of these more profound teachings. When the Buddha analyzed what it means to be human, typically he would split it up into five categories. Now, to some extent, these categories were obvious. To some extent, they were just commonplace at that time. So this is what we call the five khandhas, or sometimes they translate it into English as aggregates. Might as well use the Pali term, five khandhas. And so the first, I'm just going to go through these relatively quickly, just to see where free will fits into all of this. So the first is the body. This one's fairly obvious. You know, if we're going to identify with something as me, as mine, then, well, the body seems to be the most enduring thing. I mean, at least it seems to be almost the same from moment to moment. Yes, it changes from childhood to old age, but, you know, relatively, it's relatively stable. But that's usually where we start in terms of investigating, a systematic investigation based on a calm, focused, clear mind that's been refined in meditation. And we take a close look at the body. There are many ways to go about looking at this, but when we look at the body and all of its component parts and details and changing, constantly changing nature, then it becomes fairly obvious that this cannot be who we truly are. There is not something in the physical body, which is our enduring, unchanging self that is worthy of attaching to as the idea of our true self. The second of the five khandhas is called Vedana. Typically, this has gotten translated into English as the word feeling. It's not a precise translation. It's not a complete translation because we don't have one word in English which fits it. But essentially, when we have a sense contact, if there will be a very quick a positive or negative, a pleasant or an unpleasant reaction to that. Sometimes it's so subtle we might call it neutral. But essentially, it's when we see something, hear something, feel something, then there will be a pleasant or unpleasant reaction to that. So if we see something, green, beautiful, sunshine, typically that will bring up a sense of a pleasant reaction. And we call it beautiful. Piece of art, person, you know. That's something that, if we call it beautiful, that's called pleasant reaction. If we see something and it's unpleasant, we don't like it, then that is a negative or dukkha of Vedana. So Vedana happens at all the sense doors. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the mind. Six sense doors. Sometimes Vedana becomes only associated with physical sensations, which is something different. So every time that we hear something, if it's pleasant, we can notice our reaction to that. If it's unpleasant, we notice our reaction to that. When we experience comfort in the body, it's pleasant Vedana. We experience discomfort in the body, then that's unpleasant Vedana. Now, just watching Vedana could be a whole practice in and of itself. Because based on that subtle movement of mind, pleasant, unpleasant leads into liking, attachment, craving, I want more, and then forming perceptions based around that, forming lifestyles. You know, everything that we do is essentially based on trying to maximize pleasant Vedana in one form or another. Not necessarily hedonism, but even if it's mental, you know, thoughts, moods arising, it's very rare to find someone who is attracted to dukkha Vedana or unpleasant Vedana. Right? So generally, and some people may, even if they're into pain, even if they're into S&M, it's still like deriving some sort of pleasure from that. So the mind has a natural tendency towards pleasure, and this can be utilized in a Dharma sense. The mind is always inclining towards happiness. And then the Buddha saw this, he recognized this, and so much of our Dharma practice is based on learning how to be smarter in being happy, right? That's a whole nother talk. Now, the third of the five khandhas is called sanya. Typically, we translate it as memory or perception. Now, every time we're aware of something, you know, we're aware of something that we experience, it forms an imprint on the mind. This will be either a vague memory or a clear memory. But with that then comes perceptions based on how we experienced it at the time. The perception will be based not on, not, the perception is never objective. Right? You know, we experience something, we develop a perception, but that perception is colored by a whole myriad of other factors, one of which might simply be our mood at the time. You know? Others might be our social conditioning, our family conditioning, all sorts of factors. But we experience something, makes an imprint on the mind, the perception arises from that, and then gradually we form this reality, which is essentially a series of projected perceptions. If we take a close look at all that, we can see that this is merely, you know, all these perceptions merely arises from different causes and conditions. In no way within that, you know, these fleeting perceptions, are we going to find an unchanging, immutable sense of self that we could rightly call our true self. The fourth of the five khandhas is called sankhara. The Pali term sankhara is used in many different ways, but in this specific context, it refers to thoughts, moods, projections, and particularly those which arise from intention. Now, in Buddhism, what we mean by intention is not merely a thought, but the movement of the mind before it even arrives in our consciousness as a thought. So if you've been sitting meditation before this talk, you might, or maybe you've never experienced unwanted thinking in meditation. But if you have, then you might notice that even when we don't call upon thinking to arise, it just arises. Sometimes we want to think about something and it ceases. And so it doesn't take too long, you know, to just sit still, watching the nature of the mind, seeing, well, these thoughts, this thinking which I identify with, these thoughts are just arising by on their own. You know? Thoughts are arising on their own, they're ceasing on their own. Sometimes we can tweak them a bit, sometimes we can arrange them a bit, but essentially the stream of thoughts are just coming and going out of our control. And thoughts are fun to identify with. You know, if we have a brilliant thought, we say, that's my thought. God, I had a really good thought today. And if it's really good, then we can put a copyright on it and hopefully make some money from my thought. But when you really look at it, there are no original thoughts. Every thought is based on a previous set of causes and conditions, information that we've taken in, things that we've read, things that we've heard. The brilliant ones are usually the ones who are able to take all that and maybe rearrange it or put it together in a way that's particularly useful or hasn't been seen readily at that time. I'll talk more about this conduct because this is where free will, you know, really comes into play. But before I do, I just want to round up the five khandhas, which is, the fifth is consciousness. And what we mean by that is essentially when we see something, if there's mindfulness there, then there will be consciousness. And this is called vijnana. So the Buddha, it may feel like consciousness is either continuous, you know, until we go to sleep, but according to the way the Buddha saw the mind is that consciousness was arising and passing away in very quick succession. So we see something, if we're paying attention, if we have an eye that works and there's light and there's an object, then there's, and if we're paying attention, then there's consciousness and seeing happens. So the moment of seeing, and then that ceases. Then there's a moment of hearing. Maybe a thought arises, we're aware of a thought. Then we're aware of something in the body. We feel an itch or a movement of the body. And we're only able to be aware of one at a time. So if our conscious awareness is solely focused on seeing, we will not hear something. For example, if we're watching TV, right? Or if we're so totally absorbed in a movie, and then someone is trying to call our name, we literally will not hear that because consciousness is completely absorbed. Or in meditation, if consciousness is completely absorbed in the meditation object, you will not feel physical sensations. Right? Maybe normally after a half an hour you're starting to get aches and pains. After an hour, definite pain sets in. If you happen to absorb into your meditation object, you can sit for much longer than that and you will experience no pain whatsoever, because all of the consciousness is absorbed in one particular object. So it won't be possible to hear, certainly won't be seeing anything, and you won't be having any distracted thoughts. All of the consciousness is on one point. Okay. So consciousness is coming and going, fleeting. So with systematic observation, you can see, well, you know, this is not where a true sense of self is going to lie. Now, when I first started to do more intensive meditation, I just started watching the arising and passing away of thoughts, moment by moment. And that's where I really began to see, almost, now, I could not find a thought or a perception that had not arisen from a previous cause. Right? This idea of just spontaneously thinking something, just thinking whatever you just think whatever you want, something completely random, and still, I could see, well, that actually came from this or that came from that. It was based on these causes and conditions coming together. And so if you have the body and these mental khandhas, feeling, memory, perception, consciousness, together with thinking and mental formations, if you really cannot find an essence within that that we can call a true self, then who is it that is making decisions? Right? Who is it that is acting? You decide to come to meditation tonight. Well, who decided that? Where does that come from? It feels like there is some sense of free will. So I'd like to talk about different levels of free will or lack of free will. Because if anatta is really true, then there can't be any person behind it that's making these decisions. Right? And yet, that's so much of where our sense of self comes from. Is, look, everything's impermanent, but you know, I'm making the choices in my life. Right? At least I can decide when I want to drink a glass of water. Right? This is me making the decision. But if we really start to look at it moment by moment with a refined mind, then things start to get weird. Yeah. Take a drink. Okay, so there's certain levels of lack of free will. For example, there are times when we have almost no mindfulness. Times where we're just acting on automatic. We have almost no mindfulness, and a lot of our life is like that. A part of it is just practical. You know, stuff needs to get done. You just kind of go on automatic. When you drive the car, you don't have to think about every single detail anymore because you're on automatic. Right? That is a useful form of it, but there are many other forms of it which just means our life is kind of out of control. It's like we're driving through life and, well, you know, we're just on automatic. So many decisions in our life, especially small ones which gradually form our character, so many motivations that come up, if we just respond without having much clear awareness of what we're doing, then we're essentially living a robotic life. Right? And because we don't have mindfulness during this time, it can be even difficult to remember examples of this, because mindfulness is based on mindfulness causes memory. Memory is based on being mindful at the time. So for those times where we're really not mindful, it's actually difficult to recollect examples. But usually it's easier to see in other people. We can watch other people and we think, yeah, they're really not being mindful at all. And these moods, these desires, these motivations are arising, yeah, in other people's minds, and then we think, well, it must happen with me as well. You can see it's happening with them, and they just follow it. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, or a reaction to fear, anxiety, stress, you know, whatever, and then people just follow it, you know, based on pressure or moods, maybe family pressure, social pressure, you name it. There's a lot of pressures. And there's a lot of ways that we can just live our life on automatic. And at that level, even on the conventional level, right, there's very little free will. But let's say we start meditating, we start attempting to be consciously aware. We start developing mindfulness practice. Everything that we do, from the time we wake up in the morning until the time we go to bed at night, we attempt to be aware of our moods and emotions, our thoughts, be aware of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, be aware of how we affect other people. Right? We're making that effort. And still we run into situations where sometimes the strength of a desire or the strength of aversion just overcomes our mindfulness. It's too strong. And we feel like we do it anyways. Right? So, ice cream, for example. You know, you're out with family or friends. You know, it's not healthy. I really don't want it. Everyone's like having ice cream. Say, oh, okay, I'll take it. Just like I know I shouldn't, but I can't quite stop myself. Right? Or sometimes more serious, just like a physical attraction between people. People might be married, but then something happens and there's extremely strong physical attraction, and they feel like, I just can't stop myself. Just can't stop myself. And then, you know, even if they know this is not going to end well, right? Even if they can kind of see it, this is going to cause problems. Still, there's not enough mindfulness to be able to overcome that desire, and so we just kind of feel like we don't have any free will choice. Or getting angry, you know, who wants to get angry? And yet, you know, you go to visit your parents, or you go to work or whatever, and people say things, and you know, okay, I'm just gonna be patient, and then you know, sometimes the strength of the stimulus brings up a reaction of aversion that it overcomes our mindfulness. And then we become angry if it's strong, and we say something, we do things based on that anger. Even if at the time we know that this is not going to be helpful, right? Even if we know that this is not going to be helpful, sometimes we just get swept away. And so on the conventional level, it feels like in those situations we have no free will. Right? But let's say that those times where we have very strong mindfulness, and even situations where someone says something, someone's trying to bait us, someone tries to say something, get us upset, and we can just watch it. You know, part of the mind is just watching moods, watching feelings, mental feelings, you know, equanimous, you know, simple. Right? And then within that sphere of great mindfulness, so whatever happens within that, we can just see it come and go, right? Very still, very peaceful, very pleasant. And then we decide, oh, I'd like to have a drink of water. A sense of, oh, feeling of thirst, decision is made. There's intention to stretch an arm. There's awareness of the weight and feeling of glass. Awareness of sensation of water, awareness of gratification. Right? So when we're talking about developing mindfulness, this is essentially what we want to encourage. And paying attention to the intention, you know, is a very important aspect of that process. Right? So if we're more automatic or not paying attention, we may feel thirst, maybe have a little bit of mindfulness towards that, but we just reach. You know, we just reach for gratification. Right? But if you notice, there is intention every step of the way. Right? Maybe intention to move my arm, intention to gratify thirst, intention to lift, intention to drink and swallow. So it would seem that this intention is where free will would reside. Right? And this intention is very much a part of our Buddhist practice. Right? You read through the suttas, and the Buddha is teaching on a conventional level. Right? Where we pay attention to our intentions, noting whether it's coming from a wholesome place or an unwholesome place, and then make a conscious decision on what to do to that. So, an example of that I wanted to read out. There was one time when the Buddha was teaching his son, Rahula. Rahula came to stay with the Buddha when he was just still a young boy, and some of the teachings in the suttas are specifically given to him in private. So, for example, he was saying, Rahula, when you wish to do an action of the body, it's a way of saying physical karma, you know? When you wish to do something, or when you wish to do verbal karma, when you wish to say something, or even when you wish to think something, you should reflect upon it. That action, that speech, would this action that I wish to do with the body lead to my own affliction or to the affliction of others? Is it an unwholesome action or speech with painful consequences and painful results? When you reflect and you know if so, then either whether it would be painful for oneself or for others or lead to affliction in any way, then you should definitely not do such an action or say that. However, if you reflect and you recognize that this will not lead to either pain or suffering for myself or affliction for others, then you can go ahead. And so before speaking, before taking an action, during speaking, yeah, while we're speaking, you know, still watching the intentions. You know, where is the conversation going? Why we're acting? You know, are the intentions changing? And then after we've said something, after we've done something, reflecting back, what were the results? And so this is essentially Buddhist practice. You know, it's based on observing, you know, with every intention, is it coming from a wholesome or unwholesome place? And the Buddha had specific definitions of what that meant. And then making a conscious decision to develop the wholesome and a conscious decision to not develop the unwholesome. But what happens if all this is truly non-self? Who is making those decisions? Who's making the decisions not to steal? We say, okay, well, stealing is might offer some short-term gratification at best, but it's going to lead to suffering for other people. Who is making that decision not to steal? Who is making the decision maybe not to get angry in a provocative situation? Who is making the decision to have ice cream or not, you know, based on all of the different factors that we might take into consideration? It feels, right? It feels like there is a free will intention that is my true self, right? It can often feel like that. If we're going to attach to something as our true self, you know, what is it that is making decisions? Okay, now, when I say go, completely spontaneously either lift your left or your right arm, or do something different. One, to go. Right? Now, you would think that that should be pretty much our own decision, right? I mean, you can't really see a lot of social conditioning involved with that. I mean, maybe there is. Maybe there is. Right-handed, left-handed, etc. You know, we're not free of that. But at this period of Buddhist history, it's an interesting junction with empirical evidence that comes from cognitive neuroscience. So if we study the neurobiology of the brain and what's happening there, then it gets even weirder. Huh? Now, many experiments have been done on this, hooking people up to fMRI machines or scanners. One in particular I can think of, they tried to create a situation which would, as far as they could see, be completely free of outside influence and encouraging complete spontaneity. So they just had people using their two index fingers. I think a letter would come up, and then as soon as they would either hit left or right. And as soon as they made the decision, then they were told to press the button. Yeah? As soon as they made the decision, either left or right, press the button. Meantime, they were recording data of what was actually occurring in the brain. So you would think this would be an example of independence, right? You know, I'm making an independent decision. And when they analyzed the data, they found that they could predict before the person made a conscious decision to go right or left, they could predict what the person was going to choose. So, this is all happening on an unconscious or pre-conscious level. And when I first heard about this, I thought, well, the time previous to the actual conscious decision may be just nanoseconds. But no, it's more like at least half a second, often a couple of seconds, sometimes as long as 10 seconds, right? Which in terms of the mind is a long, long time. So they could measure, however they do it, and then take all the data and crunch the numbers, and they could measure, not in real time, because it's not quite that fast yet, but afterwards, you know, they could see the mind was going to make this decision. What they call the brain or the mind was going to go right or left. And that decision was made unconsciously before the person made a conscious choice. So this then really throws the idea of free will up for discussion, if not out the window. So now, even if I am absolutely mindful, say, sensation of thirst, decision made to stretch my arm, right, even if I, technically, I know all of this has occurred in my mind, in my brain, before I've made a conscious decision, before, you know, even if we're absolutely mindful of that time, the decision has been made prior to me having an intention to gratify my thirst. So this then leads into a whole mess, because essentially the law of karma is based on intention. Our social justice system is based on the idea that people have free will to choose how they behave. And if they don't have free will, then how can you punish someone? Personal relationships. How do we choose our partners? How did you choose your partners? If there's no free will. Almost every area of our life and society in some ways is based on this idea that we are in some ways independent entities with free will to make choices. And if this is called into question, then things start to get a bit weird. Now, on one hand, you can say, well, technically, we can understand, or theoretically, scientifically, we can understand this. But it doesn't really make a difference in people's lives. But from the standpoint of a Buddhist meditator, if we're going to take this idea of anatta, non-self, we're really going to bring this, you know, into our lives and take it deeper and deeper and deeper, then these are places where the sense of self hides out, where we need to bring our attention to. Here's another quote from not necessarily a Buddhist source, but Stephen Hawking. He said, "Recent experiments in neuroscience support the view that it is our physical brain, following the known laws of science, that determine our actions, and not some agency outside these laws. It is difficult to imagine how free will can operate if our behavior is determined by physical law. So it seems we are no more than biological machines, and that free will is just an illusion." But when has he ever been right before? And anyways, that's just scientific fact. I mean, that's just science, you know. And, you know, you present this to people and say, that's scientific fact. We'll say, well, I have alternative facts. You know, I know that I'm independent. I know I'm self-sufficient. Don't tell me I'm not a person who I can be spontaneous whenever I want. I'll show you. Right? But we're talking about free will on different levels. You know, there's the conventional level of free will, but then even if we're absolutely mindful and you're really getting down to the nitty-gritty of where the sense of self resides, then you say, well, let's take a look at this, who we think is making our decisions moment by moment. So how does this then affect the law of karma? Okay, so essentially the Buddhist idea of law of karma is that from beginningless time there's this mass of causes and conditions that have led up to this present moment. And then with what we're presented with right now, we make the conscious decision on how we want to respond. If we're not mindful, then we tend to just respond according to habits, conditioned habits. If we are mindful, then whatever happens, pleasant, unpleasant, wanted, unwanted, then we have the power and choice to respond as we wish. And so this is the essence of Buddhist practice, right? This is what we have right here, right now, and then we literally create our future by the decision that is made at that moment. Very dynamic way of idea of karma. Not at all fatalistic, very dynamic. Constant interplay between, you know, the past, arriving in the present, we make a choice that creates our future, moment after moment. So that's very freeing. We're not just limited by past causes and conditions. Very freeing. We can choose how we're going to respond. Yeah. And then from that, there's a great sense of independence that arises. I mean, Buddhist practice is essentially teachings on freedom, liberation, emancipation. You know, and And that's true, and yet who is making the decision on how we respond? If this is happening somehow in our brains before we make a conscious decision, then where does that come from? And then if we're going to attach to something as our true self, it would make more sense to attach to these neural processes that are happening before we're aware of making a conscious decision, except that we can't do that because we can't see them. Yeah. By definition, they're not conscious, they're not visible. Now the Buddha was, this is an understatement, a very wise person. So he recognized that he taught on many different levels, all different propensities. And so he most of his teachings are actually very much on the conventional level, you know, viewing other people in terms of actual people. But then on deeper levels, realize, well, they're actually not people in that sense. They're not a being in that sense. Even a person, you know, ourselves, is just a momentary collection of a particular set of physical and mental activities, you know, that's constantly in flux. So the law of karma, you know, needs to be approached from that direction. You have to still use it on the conventional level and try to master it, you know, on the conventional level. But then at some point, this teaching of anatta, you know, actually has to be turned in on that which is making the decisions itself. And then you have, you know, social implications. If people really start to accept this idea that, oh, we're merely biological machines, as Hawkins puts it, with no free will, then if you take that alone, that could lead to dangerous behavior, irresponsible behavior. No matter what you do, say, hey, it wasn't me who made the decision. I can't be held responsible. It was just neural processes in my mind that occurred before my conscious decision. But it's interesting just in terms of For example, law and social justice. How important free will is within that. Now, if you go swimming in the ocean and you get stung by a jellyfish, that you may have burns over parts of your body, very painful. But even if you caught that very jellyfish who stung you, normally you would not call the police and insist that that jellyfish be arrested, taken to jail, or sued. Right? Normally. But if you're sitting on the same beach, just enjoying the sunshine with your eyes closed, and then another person walked by with some diluted acid and spilled acid over you, intentionally threw acid on you, and you had the exact same amount of burns, you would want some action taken. Yeah. You would want to call some authority. You would want to some recourse. So why is that? Because you could say the person was just acting by instinct, in the same way you could say the jellyfish was acting by instinct. You know, what's the difference between the two? And then you get into gray areas where there are some animals which do seem more mindful and responsible, higher animals. I can probably think of, imagine a number of dolphins who are probably morally responsible than a number of human beings. Right? And yet we wouldn't hold the dolphins to the same legal standard of punishment that we would with human beings. Why? Because we tend to, why? We project free will on humanity. Yeah. Is it just an arrogance thing? You know, we have free will, therefore, you know, we deserve a special set of laws. I mean, you can find many, many examples. You know, of if you get if a young primate kills the alpha male for sexual privileges, then we say, well, that's just nature. Yeah. But if that happens in Seattle, then I don't know. You don't just say it's nature. Oh, that's just nature. You know, that's a serious crime. But we don't call animals killing each other murder. You know? Because often it comes down to this free will. But to what degree are we different from other animals, especially animals that have higher development? I mean, all of these are big areas, and I can only touch on some of these and maybe raise some questions. Another big one is theistic religions. You know, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, in particular, based upon essential, I mean, there's wide ranging, but the essence of it is if you make the conscious choice to believe in whatever belief they are ascribing, then you're saved. Then you're good for eternity. Right? But it's based on mankind or personkind making that decision, you know, to choose good over evil, to choose however you want to put it. So, if you take free will out of the picture, then that puts some of the theistic religions on very shaky ground. I mean, there's other good aspects to it that you find that are in common with Buddhism as well, but the essence of it, you know, is brought into question. So there's whole aspects of our society that if free will is brought into question, can raise some serious issues. So that often this is something that people just don't want to think about. You know, it's just easier, you know, to not to think about the implications. And no matter what opinion we might have of it, actual experience of watching a rising and passing away of intention really needs to come out of a refined meditation practice. Right? So this is not meant to be just an intellectual overview, because thinking our way around these issues will only still just scratch the surface. It's only when mindfulness becomes very consistent, the mind is calmed with a depth, distracted thinking, it's really not an issue anymore. Mindfulness becomes honed so that moment by moment we're able to watch, you know, without the mind slipping away. We're able to watch our own minds, the intentions arising, passing away, changing. So that's where it is most useful, you know, for us. Like with many things, you just have to relax and let it happen. So I offer this for your reflection this evening. So, happy to answer any questions that may have arisen. Yes. Who's asking the question? Sorry, it's a question, trick question.
I was ready to tell you my
question. You realize how quickly we identify with that. Those two words in there. Okay, please. Sorry.
I'm a great believer in science. and yet I found some questioning around that one study you cited, and you said it was one among many. And I do not read neuroscientific literature. But, you know, there is talk about that science can't find consciousness.
Can what?
Cannot find consciousness.
Find, huh, yeah.
And so, there's part of me that isn't going to say, oh, okay, so these tests, you know, show that the brain had this electrical activity, and it always predicted what a person did beforehand, and that means that, I don't know what it means, actually, but I don't feel like compelled to think that that absolutely means something about what you were talking about. I mean, maybe it does, and
right.
It's like completely over my head. It doesn't answer anything about free will. And then my other thing is I want to ask you, it's sort of a question that I expect you won't answer. Do you think that there's free will? I mean, and I know that this is an open thing, and there isn't a. I just want some of your wisdom and your experience. And,
uh-huh.
I don't know.
So the first part of your question is, science is always evolving, and this particular area is very new. There's a lot of groundbreaking things, very new. There's a lot in cognitive neuroscience which supports what Buddhist meditators have been saying for thousands of years, and so there's a lot there. Like any scientific data, it's good to take it, but recognize science is an evolving art. Yeah, it's not an endpoint. Especially with the idea of consciousness. It's very new. Typically, in our tradition, we would say, oh, well, how does consciousness work with the rest of the mind and the body? And it was a bit like, well, your body and your brain, it's a bit like, well, let's take the brain, right? Brain's a bit like the hardware, and then consciousness is like the software. You know, it makes use of that. But it's energy, non-physical, conscious awareness that is related to the brain, but is not the brain. You take consciousness out of the brain, you just have dead matter. You know, so consciousness, you know. But if you take consciousness away from a body, say we die, and then whether these near-death experiences are indicative of exactly what happens, we don't know for sure. But let's say a sense of awareness arises out of a freshly deceased body, and then begins a process of connecting again with more physical matter. It's what we call rebirth. Right? So that's a traditional way that we would look at the relationship between consciousness and physical matter. Yeah. I personally find this fascinating, because as soon as I start to really consider who is making the decisions and where it's coming from, it just calls into question nearly everything that I do. So well, why am I doing this? Right? I mean, why did I decide to be a monk? It certainly wasn't social conditioning from growing up in Minnesota. You know, it wasn't social. It wasn't family pressure from my parents. And yet, unless you can say that my father didn't want me to be a monk and I was rebelling, you know, okay, we could psychoanalyze it. But just like on a daily basis, so where did these decisions come from? And then it puts me into a space where I can more just experience things as a flow of arising and passing away. Right? It's like as if I am much more within a web, the universal web of causes and conditions, and this me that feels like I'm this, you know, I'm the center and making decisions kind of fades away a bit. And so I find it helpful in that way. Right? And it's helpful for experiencing that sense of being connected with everything. Right? If we really feel like we are independent, self-sufficient, then that cuts us off, this idea. I mean, it's not accurate anyways, but that notion of being, I'm independent and free, and I'm going to act that way, well, it tends to have the action, the result of cutting oneself off, or at least not recognizing the connections that are there already. And so this idea that decisions that are made are, for the most part, based on a complicated series of causes and past conditions that have kind of come together in this moment, and then this is the latest unfolding, or it's like a water fountain that, you know, is coming up, and then just this moment where it, you know, it's no longer coming up but not falling yet, you know, and then falls away. It's like each moment is like that. It's just constant unfolding, and it helps me just to step back a bit and be able to watch this, recognize the connections more, and in a sense enjoy it. It becomes more enjoyable when you don't feel like you have to control everything. You realize, well, there's no one. It's a hopeless venture to try to control things anyways, and so you kind of step back a bit and let that go, and it feels like it goes in the right direction. Yes?
Are you equating consciousness to awareness, or is awareness something other than consciousness?
In this discussion, I would equate them, yes. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about being mindful, being attentive, attention, being aware, awareness, these are just different terms, but essentially talking about the same thing.
But sometimes you separate it out.
There are times where the Buddha may use different terms. In different contexts, he might use different terms for what in one context might be vijnana, in a different context he might use a different term. But essentially he's referring to the same thing. Okay, so here's a question. If there's no free will, then that means everything is determined, right? Sorry, that's really where it gets messy and say, well, if there's no free will, then you flip to the other extreme and say, well, that must mean that everything is predetermined and fixed, and no matter what I do, the outcome's going to be the same, or there's just an illusion of free will, therefore, you know, it's all kind of written out, the whole future is written out already. And there's just a delusion that I'm somehow having an effect on the outside world, which is merely, then if that's the case, what is the function of being conscious and thinking that we have free will? It's just to make us feel better, make us feel important, or what? So the Buddha was very clear that he was not teaching fate. He was not teaching an idea that things were fixed. And sometimes the word karma, in particular, becomes identified with a fatalistic way of looking at something, a deterministic way of looking at something. Let's say, well, it's just his karma, man. You know, it's like it had to happen. He couldn't escape it. It's just our karma. But that's not the way the Buddha used the term. The way the Buddha was teaching it is a very dynamic interplay between our free will and the present moment. But then if you call into question the free will, well, maybe it is determined then. Right? So that's where things started to get weird for me. When I was looking at this, it's like, I was kept trying to figure out, there must have been some decisions I made in my life that were free will. And no matter how I looked at things, everything, well, but that was just based on that, and that was just based on that. And you know, you would think, well, the decision to become a monk, that must be free. But that's just based on a whole series of, you know, thousands of smaller decisions that many of which actually just seemed to be out of my control. So I think reflecting on this is very helpful for questioning our role and our place within the wider sphere of everything, right? I mean, basically the universe is a series of causes and conditions, and somehow we're in the midst of this, and we feel special because we have a brain and a prefrontal cortex that's bigger than others. But really, if you take that away, then how... what is our role in all of this? And that then does then come back. It's not just a theoretical exercise, right? It comes back and it changes our relationship with our surroundings and the rest of our life, our relationships with people, our relationships with things, how important we feel. You know, realize, well, we don't have to be the center of the universe. And in fact, if we recognize we're not the center of the universe, we're going to be a lot happier. And so, you know, all of these things then become very practical and lead then into, you know, gradual changes and transformation in our life.
My name is Susan. I wake up parts of the day and know that I've been away, and I want to draw a connection between the jellyfish and waking up, because so when I catch myself, when I wake up, and a lot of it is like I wake up when I feel myself brushing. So I don't want to say I, but I'm using that just conventionally.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So. This commitment to wake up and awareness is also a power that is a force, you know, not myself, because I'm mm-hmm. not waking up. Something, mm-hmm. and maybe I'm, you know, it's another... You know, it's a training. And then yet I also wake up to myself, and I can liken it to like a scan on a barcode. It just like grabs, I can see the self grab onto something, the jellyfish. And then I almost like, I don't know what to do. It's almost, I fumble a little bit and realize I've done it. The self congealed again, and I'm kind of like, okay, there it is. I just don't know what to do with it. So I'm observing, well, I think that, you know, awareness is observing, and I see myself glomming on, mm-hmm. and I see the letting go, if you will, or the waking up again and in contact with that, but it's, the continuity is very different. Continuity, I, you know.
You're not alone. You're not alone, and this is just the way it is. You know, we start, even if we're trying to be ultimately mindful, and we have very little distractions. We got our eyes closed. We're sitting still. There's no, hardly any other sounds, and still it's difficult to be mindful moment to moment. You know, to say nothing of when we're in the midst of a grocery store, or at work, or driving down the highway, right? So even in optimal conditions, it's difficult to maintain moment-by-moment mindfulness. So you have to be really patient with yourself, right? But we got to start somewhere. And so if you're sitting for 30 minutes and you have a few moments of clarity in there, okay, that's good. That's good. And then we build on that, you know. And we build on it so that, okay, it becomes easier to be present at a few moments while we're sitting meditation. Then when we open our eyes, don't just rush into something, right? Pay attention to the transition. It's very important. You know? If we're meditating, bell goes off, and then we go jump up and rush off, do something, then it becomes very difficult to integrate, you know, what we learn and what we experience when we're sitting. So just because we open our eyes and change our posture doesn't mean that anything else has changed in terms of our relationship to developing mindfulness. All right. So, okay, eyes open now, there's a lot more to pay attention to. Okay, I can be aware of sight and color and shape and form. And then as we pay attention to our physical sensations while we're sitting, and then we make the decision. Someone makes the decision, or maybe a decision just happens to get up. You know, there are decisions. And so whether we make the decision or someone else makes a decision or no one makes a decision, there are decisions being made, and we can be aware of, okay, there's a decision being made to get up. And then we change our posture, but we're still kind of immersed in awareness of the body,